This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Thomas Rinaldi. He runs the blog New York Neon. Thomas, it is great having you back on the show.
It's great to be here.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter.
It's nice talking to you.
We recently had Robert Brenner on the show, and he runs these walking tours of Times Square, focusing on the era of the 1970s. You also have your own walking tours that focuses on neon in New York. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, mine are looking at storefront signs, really, as opposed to big Times Square types of signs, and more kind of like neighborhood sorts of businesses like restaurants and bars. And that's been sort of the focus of the book that I wrote and the blog that I maintain. And so I've tried a couple of different neighborhoods in New York and sort of settled on the East Village and the West Village, Greenwich Village, as being kind of the places that where the tours work the best and make the most sense and where there's the most to see.
What is unique about those areas? You mentioned Greenwich Village, then the East Village. Is there the highest concentration of surviving signs?
Yeah, that is what I found. I actually, in doing the book, made a spreadsheet of every sign that I photographed, which is every neon storefront sign that I could find in the five boroughs of New York City that appeared to have been made before about 1970. And so there are about maybe 400 or so signs on the list, and I could break them all up by neighborhood that they were in. And doing it this way, you could figure out, okay, well, which neighborhoods have the most? And it turned out to be Greenwich Village that had the most, which is almost a little counterintuitive because Greenwich Village people think of as being sort of like this quaint, historic part of the city with these quirky little streets and these, you know, small, kind of small scale, low rise, 19th century and even older residential buildings. But in fact, this is the neighborhood with the highest concentration of surviving neon, old neon signs in New York City. And the East Village is up there, too, in terms of concentration. So I'm not sure what exactly that tells us about, you know, what the sort of propensity or what it is that keeps such places around, you know. But there's something about Greenwich Village that seemed to have the ingredients to kind of sort of lent itself to the survival of independently owned businesses that go way back for multiple generations of ownership. Not sure exactly what it is, but kind of thought provocative.
Yeah, it's interesting looking at the kind of dynamics of independent businesses and their survival. In some areas, they're very low-income communities that resist gentrification. But obviously, Greenwich Village is very expensive. But there's still a strong interest in patronizing those places.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. I found that in some of the lower income neighborhoods that had sort of suffered the most in the rough years in New York in the 70s and 80s during the financial crisis, that those neighborhoods, very few of these kinds of places survived in those neighborhoods. So Greenwich Village, despite being, you know, one of the most sort of prosperous, if you will, neighborhoods in the city, somehow these places managed to survive there in kind of the densest numbers, although that has changed quite a lot in recent years.
What has been the situation with surviving neon signs in lower income areas and some of the outer boroughs in places like the Bronx?
Well, I've found that there wasn't much that survived in those neighborhoods. And, you know, for whatever reason, one could certainly speculate on the reasons. I think, you know, in general, you know, neighborhoods where they did survive or neighborhoods where they didn't survive. I mean, one of the interesting things about these signs and studying them is that I think they're kind of an indicator species. I've always thought of them that way. And their disappearance in recent years is kind of an indicator for the kinds of changes that are affecting the city now. And, you know, a lot of people look at them, and I myself included, as changes for the worse. You know, they're in terms of the pressures that are putting a lot of independent businesses out of business, you know, and the kind of proliferation of big box kind of corporate chain businesses in New York, the disappearance of these old neon signs is kind of an indicator, a barometer of that change. But I think they're a barometer of other kinds of changes too. And very often things that we don't understand exactly, but they're still kind of an indicator. But in sort of the neighborhoods of the Bronx that had really, you know, been kind of known to have, you know, really suffered, like I said, during the 70s and 80s, you know, these kinds of signs and the businesses that went along with them, I found were very few and far between.
Most of these places you're talking about are small businesses. On our previous show, you mentioned that originally neon was popular with large corporate chains in the very beginning, like in the 30s and 40s, and even the 50s.
Yeah, that to me was another one of the great ironies of the story of neon, is that, you know, it's thought of now as being associated with mom and pop kinds of independent businesses, the signs of old neon signs in New York. But in fact, the first ones were put up by big chain corporations, like the car companies and chain kind of soda fountain kinds of places. But as the 1920s, you know, morphed into the 1930s, independent businesses managed to, you know, kind of get into the game too. And then by the end of the 1930s, the big corporations were really turning their backs on neon. And so neon became really kind of, divorced from the big corporations in those years.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of ironic, but I'm sure there was a time in history, like in the 60s, when cultural critics would probably dismiss neon as being trashy or associating it with being like too corporate in a sense.
Definitely, you know, and you know, it's another one of these kinds of ironies in the history of neon, is that it came to be sort of like a shorthand for, you know, corporate commodity pushers kind of ripping you off, when in fact, you know, are almost synonymous with sort of like plastic and that kind of thing. But in fact, neon is very much a handcraft. It's a craft that really has not changed in more than 100 years or so. And, you know, even as those associations were being made, the most famously probably in The Sounds of Silence, the Simon and Garfunkel song, even as those kinds of things were being written and those kinds of associations were being made, big corporations really had, you know, if you really looked at things in a literal way, big corporations were not the kinds of businesses where you found neon signs, even by the 50s and 60s. They had found cheaper kinds of signs by then, and neon signs were already kind of old-fashioned, and at that point were already kind of the domain of independent businesses, be they seedy hotels or, you know, kind of dime-a-dance parlors or the kinds of places that were going to turn into, you know, like adult novelty establishments in the next couple of decades, or just, you know, more innocuous independent restaurants and bars and things like that, neighborhood anchors.
I mean, historically, obviously, Times Square was the main center of neon, and that changed with the whole renovation to all the corporate chain stores and electronic billboards. Are there still some surviving signs on some of the side streets, and can you give some of the best examples?
I'm very glad you asked that question, because it's something I find very interesting, you know, kind of at the micro level in the history of this subject in New York City. Is that there's basically almost nothing left anywhere near Times Square in the way of vintage neon, if you will. In Times Square itself, you know, the square is probably brighter now than it ever has been, thanks to. But it's basically just, you know, an incredible display of the world's largest TV screens. Times Square. And there's even just looking for new neon signs, it's sort of hard to find them. You'll find kind of a little bit here or there. But in terms of signs that were really kind of like around for the heyday of Times Square, and say, or certainly the heyday of neon in Times Square in like the 1950s, there's almost nothing left. You got to go a block or two away from Times Square. Probably the closest thing you get is a giant parking garage sign on West 43rd Street. It is the West 43rd Street Garage, so on the north side of 43rd Street, closer to 8th Avenue, so the better part of a full city block west of Times Square, and it's a giant, it's probably 5 stories high, just says garage in huge letters, and it kind of, you know, it still lights up a little bit feebly, But if you there's a about 2 seconds in the movie Shaft where you can see this thing in kind of in more of its heyday. And at that time, it was multiple colors and it was flashing in this kind of animated sequence. Now it just kind of glows red all the time. But that's probably the closest thing you're going to find to like an authentic, genuine relic of the neon signs in Times Square, like the puffing camel cigarette sign, which would have been more or less a contemporary of this one surviving parking garage sign that's there.
It's interesting you brought that up with Robert Brenner. We were discussing this place called the Hotel Carter, which is being renovated. It was once called the dirtiest hotel in America. And I asked him about the hotel that parking sign, and he said he'll look it up to see if it's still there.
I think I've seen it before.
Last time I walked by, I was still there.
Yeah, I saw it too. I know I'm looking it up online, and I've seen it, but I wasn't. It didn't transfer in my mind it was neon. I just thought it just blends in so perfectly.
Yeah, well, you know, the neon really only faces the direction of traffic. I think that it faces Times Square. I think the west-facing side of the sign, they took the neon off, actually. Yeah, but it's a great relic. You know, to me, at this point, it's one of the most evocative relics of Times Square. And it's really kind of this... you know, anonymous sort of thing that I don't think anyone really looks at. But, you know, if you look at it and really stop to think about this thing, you know, I think it's a remarkable kind of relic.
What about some of the theaters on 42nd Street, like the New Amsterdam?
Well, the New Amsterdam, yes, is actually another example of a surviving sign, you know, from that kind of era of neon. And I sort of forgot about it in talking about it now because the New Amsterdam Theater has been so, you know, made over and kind of really beautifully restored. In fact, you know, architecturally, it's one of the most significant theaters in New York City. You know, it's actually kind of an Art Nouveau landmark that goes back to the turn of the century. I think it opened around the year that Times Square became called Times Square in 1904. And it turned into more of a movie house by the 1930s and got this big neon sign that was then altered in the 1950s. And when it came time to restore the theater, you know, under the auspices of the Disney Corporation in the 90s, there was some debate as to whether or not this neon, it's not so much a neon marquee, there's a vertical sign. But there was a debate as to whether or not this thing should be restored because this is a 1904 movie theater and the sign was not original to the theater. But fortunately, the argument in favor of keeping the sign sort of prevailed. And so this thing's really kind of lost in a sea of LEDs on 42nd Street near Times Square now. But this is also a great relic of that era. I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah.
I'm looking at the picture of the McDonald's on 42nd Street.
I was about to say, I've been to the McDonald's, but I've seen that theater, but I once again never seen the that it's not neon, the McDonald's. It's just flashing. And I was just like, look at the exotic McDonald's in New York City. Let's go.
Well, there is right on Times Square a McDonald's with a what at this point it could really be looked at as a vintage neon, like a grand, crazy, extravagant neon kind of marquee. This is on the east side of Times Square around 46th Street. And the sign, I don't think of it as being old. It was probably installed in the 1980s. But at this point, you know, that's getting to be old. And every time I walk past it, I'm kind of amazed that it's still there. It's this big kind of animated neon sign. Like I said, just sort of the northeast side of Times Square. I think that's probably not long for this world, but yeah, that's sort of the genuine article. Although, you know, I don't think of the 80s as being kind of like the glory days of neon in Times Square, but there it is, still there.
Are there some other good examples of newer neon signs being built in that area and in New York in general?
Well, I find that neon is very much in vogue right now, at least, you know, maybe not so much in the kind of context that it was historically, but it is really kind of popping up all over the place. And there's a pretty decent neon trade. I was just talking to a friend of mine who's a neon sign maker in Brooklyn and Queens, and he says business is not bad. It's actually pretty good now. I mean, you know, and there was a while when you know, LEDs were really taking over and kind of the workhorse neon signs. were losing ground to, lost their ground completely to LEDs, basically. There are a lot of signs that were lit with neon that you wouldn't even, you know, have realized were lit with neon. You wouldn't think of them as neon signs, like signs for, you know, like CVS pharmacies and that kind of thing that were covered in plastic actually had neon underneath the plastic. And subtly, because you can't see the neon in those signs, they all pretty much transferred to LED over the course of the past like 6 or 7 years or so. So the sign shops whose neon guys were, you know, had got work from those kinds of signs, even though you didn't see their work in the finished product, you know, all that work disappeared. And so the concern was, well, what's there going to be for these guys to do? And so the sign shops basically, once there was a time when you could describe a sign shop as being a neon shop, or a sign shop. You could use that term, that phrase, almost interchangeably. And so that, in the past 10 years or so, really stopped being the case. So sign shops went back to being sign shops. But neon has really kind of persisted as kind of like a novelty. And so for the last couple of years, every kind of, you know, major chain retailer in New York, you find them, you know, like on Broadway and Soho, and everything, you know, The Gap, you know, right on down the list, had some kind of neon, say like a neon window display. American Apparel is one that was really, really big on neon for their storefronts, and then, you know, kind of as almost like props throughout the store. And so this kind of remains popular, and it seems to be getting, you know, even more popular. And again, with kind of like the independently owned sorts of businesses, the, you know, restaurants and cafes and coffee shops that you'll see in Brooklyn and Manhattan, you know, are really kind of seizing on this medium to convey something. Probably, you know, neon is so multifaceted, and its appeal is so multifaceted that, you know, what that something is that these businesses are trying to kind of, you know, cash in on or convey. And using neon is probably not something that can be described in super simple terms, but it's happening, and you know it's very good for business for the neon shops, and I hope it lasts. You know, and you know, I, frankly, I think it kind of makes the places that, you know, put these things up, it makes them kind of more interesting to be in and look at and so on. So so yeah, the business is fairly good, but it's not. You know, still not, and certainly never will be what it once was, this, you know, kind of workhorse of the sign industry.
So most of the stuff being made by these shops, it's small-scale projects for, say, like bars or a lot of, especially a lot of indoor signage. I think you even wrote a blog post about indoor neon.
Yeah, I did one on, I mean, I think that post, if I remember right, was one where, you know, I was looking at places where old signs have been taken and used as basically decor, you know, actual old storefront signs.
I think they even had one of the eyeballs from the old Times Square peep shows.
You know, there was the Times Square Visitor Center, which unfortunately is no longer around. I think they figured that the real estate it was taking up in Times Square just got to be so valuable that it didn't make sense to have a visitor center there anymore, unfortunately, because while it lasted, it was great. It was in this beautiful old movie theater that had been kind of nicely restored, and one of the very few old movie theaters right on Times Square that really survives intact. And so one of the real estate developers that had taken down a building that had this old peep show neon sign on 42nd Street kind of held on to it sort of for, you know, kitsch value and was able – it was restored and installed in the Times Square Visitor Center and was there for a number of years. I don't know what's become of it since the Visitor Center's closed, but it was nice while it lasted.
You've also written about a synthetic neon. Is the History Channel sign, is that synthetic or that's authentic? You've written about that.
Well, what happened with the History Channel sign was this great big rooftop sign that, you know, was on a kind of warehouse roof over a highway in the Bronx as you pass from Upper Manhattan into the Bronx across the Harlem River. And what was fascinating to me about this, as I learned in kind of studying the subject, was that the sign, which had been was a Newport cigarette sign in my childhood, but this particular rooftop had been, you know, the location of this huge illuminated sign going back for many generations, going back I think at one point it predated neon and was an incandescent bulb sign on this roof. And so the sign over the years just kind of descended from one brand to the next. It was cigarettes, it was gasoline. And finally it wound up being as the History Channel. And so the History Channel had this giant rooftop neon sign over this warehouse for maybe 15 or 20 years or so. And it came down just last year and has been replaced with an iHeartRadio rooftop sign, which unfortunately the chain is now broken because this thing is not, it's not neon. In fact, it's not even internally lit. It's kind of just floodlit. So they put up these like reflective letters and floodlit them, which was a much more kind of cost-effective solution. But unfortunately, the kind of legacy of these, you know, some of them were really elaborate. These great old rooftop signs in this location is sort of broken. But there is still a sort of commercial presence there, and you know, maybe the next sign that goes up will be something sort of more in keeping with the sort of extravagance of the signs that were there historically. But there is this whole thing of fake neon, which I did a blog post on a couple of weeks ago. And I keep seeing more and more and more and more of it. I was just in Europe and I was seeing fake neon all over the place there too. And you see it. It seems like there are, I would guess that there are fonts available. Or it's becoming sort of a graphic design trope. Where you know, the graphics have just gotten to the point where you can kind of make letter forms on a poster that really look like a photograph of a neon tube. I mean, they're photorealist. You know, some of them are so good, I almost wonder if it is in fact a photo of a sign that was made. But you're not actually looking at a real sign, a real neon sign. You're looking at a poster, a two dimensional thing, and you see it advertising all kinds of things, and some of them are, you know, like I said, incredibly convincing. Some of them are really pretty crude, but they're all kind of going for the same look. And to me, it's really kind of a testament to the sort of appeal of neon, you know, and sort of the point that it's at right now, which you know, it seems to be an aesthetic that people respond favorably towards. You know, at least that's sort of what the people who are constantly deploying it, you know, this fake neon all over the place, that seems to be what they think. it's kind of interesting to me more than anything, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, you know, and so I think that's kind of, that's what I take home from this. But you look around and you start to notice it, and then suddenly you see it all over the place. So anyone listening to this, next time you're out and about, take a look and you see it in like sort of bus stop signs and advertisements on buses and taxi roofs. You see it in posters for, you know, like shows coming up at music venues, you know, all kinds of different things, advertisements for different, you know, cable and, you know, like Netflix shows and things like that. There's a series called Riverdale. I think there's a series called Good Behavior. You know, that seems to be using this this kind of graphic fake neon convention now. Used all over the place. Interesting thing. Yeah.
Every year you write about a signs lost this year, and I think out of the ones, I think the most remarkable one that was removed was the hectogram clock in Jersey City.
Yeah, that was one. Technically you could say it wasn't removed, but it was pretty much completely rebuilt, and it went from neon to LED.
They didn't destroy it. They kept the shape, but they replaced the neon with LED.
Yeah, they basically made a facsimile of what had been there. And, you know, in fact, the sign predates neon. It was for the Colgate. The Colgate, you know, like the toothpaste, had a huge factory on the Jersey City waterfront opposite Lower Manhattan. And this thing was on the roof of the factory there going back to the early 20th century. It was lit with incandescent bulbs and then later was kind of reconstructed and neonized. Colgate has long since left Jersey City, but this big clock was taken off the roof of a warehouse that was being demolished and kind of installed right on the waterfront as a landmark, and is still there. but was completely rebuilt, and so all the neon was taken off, and it really kind of, you know, it had this great patina of having been, you know, weathering, you know, New York Harbor for many decades, and all of that's kind of gone. So, I'm glad it's still there, you know, in a certain iteration, and one could say that even the neon was a rehash of an earlier sign, so, you know, people could have lamented the incandescent bulbs that made way for the neon. So I'm glad something's still there, but I certainly miss, this thing that really felt like a genuine artifact, a really big, visually engaging, genuine artifact. But, you know, you look at this thing from across the river in Manhattan and probably, you know, most people, even I would have a hard time noticing, this change took place. In fact, it took me a couple of years to notice that they did it. But it was a bummer to find out. Even after the fact. So,
what happened with the Domino Sugar Factory in Brooklyn, which was planned for redevelopment?
Well, it's being redeveloped, and it remains to be seen. So, this beautiful kind of Victorian industrial building on the Williamsburg-Brooklyn waterfront was another one of these industrial sites on the waterfront that advertised itself, or that the owners took advantage of this waterfront location for advertising purposes, and put a great big illuminated roof sign on top of the building. And the Domino sign there, I'm sure, predated neon and was, in fact, at one point incandescent bulb, and then became neon. And then, as various additions were put onto the factory, the most recent incarnation of the sign, I think, dated to the mid 1960s or so. Was built by the Art Craft Strauss Sign Company, which made all the big Times Square signs. But this was a very typical kind of thing in New York Harbor. It was a character-defining feature of the waterfront. In fact, at one point, to see these giant roof signs, almost every single big waterfront warehouse had a giant illuminated roof sign on it. And this was taking advantage, maybe at one point, of the commuters on ferries crossing the river or other kinds of riverboats. But later on, of course, these elevated highways were built along the waterfront, pretty much almost the entire perimeter of Manhattan. Certainly Manhattan sort of below Midtown.
I do see this picture for the planned redevelopment of the sign on top of the old factory for the redevelopment, but I have no idea how accurate that rendering is.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, all these waterfront signs, eventually they were made illegal, and the only ones that survived did so because they were kind of grandfathered in. And one by one, they kind of all disappeared. So Domino, the sugar refinery, left the building. It sat empty for a number of years. It's now being converted into, of course, luxury residential. What else on the waterfront? And, one of the kind of selling points that the developer kind of seized on for this project was, we'll keep the sign. We'll keep that Domino roof sign that had been there for so long and reincorporate it into the project. And so that, at last check, was still on the books, was still something that was going to happen. However, I'm not sure how they're going to be able to do it, because the zoning ordinances are such that the thing has been removed now for long enough that I'm not sure it would still be legal to put it there without getting an exemption or variance from the zoning. So to me, I'm optimistic, because I think, it'd be great to see the thing come back. Really, the very last of its kind. But there are renderings, showing it there, but in real life, it is still a TBD, so stay tuned to see what happens there.
Have you heard of the CNA Sugar Factory in Crockett, California, in the East Bay area?
I have not heard of that.
With Ghirardelli Square in San Francisco, I mean, that was originally an old factory, and they renovated it, and they kept a lot of the original signage.
Yes, of course, and that, that's one. I think that might be. I'm pretty sure that's incandescent bulb, but it's the same idea of basically an industrial, kind of waterfront concern advertising itself with one of these big roof signs. And New York is certainly not unique in having them, but you know, they are sort of a kind of bygone staple of urban waterfronts, and where they do survive, you know, I think you know, they are awfully appealing.
We were talking about the hectogram clock in Jersey City. What are some of the best surviving neon clock signs? I know the only one in New York I can think of is the one on the Paramount Theater in Times Square.
Yeah, so at one point, there's a number of early and mid-20th century skyscrapers in New York City that have giant clocks on them that were part of the original design of the buildings. And I kind of, you know, said, oh, I got to get pictures of all these great big neon clocks on these buildings. So I went around to photograph them. And in the process of doing so, I realized that most of them are, in fact, not neon. And the Paramount Theater one has, I think the hands of the clock are neon, but I don't think anything else on that clock is neon. There are others. A lot of them, it turned out, were actually, you know, predated neon and were incandescent. Lit with incandescent, and as far as I know, were never neon. They've now been kind of like switched over to LED. So the Con Edison building near Union Square is one of these with a you know, enormous clock that kind of beams out over Union Square. This is, of course, the you know, major electrical utility for New York City. The old Metropolitan Life Insurance Company building on Madison Square is another one that I believe, as far as I know, was never neon. The one, though, that is neon and was, at the time of its installation, billed as the largest neon clock in the world, it was the Williamsburg Savings Bank Tower in downtown Brooklyn, which at this point is almost lost in a forest of high-rise buildings in Brooklyn. But until very recently was, you know, alone on the skyline. And, you know, you could still see that this, you know, big, you know, red kind of smear on the skyline from very far away. For a long time, it was never working right, or, you know, it wouldn't be lit up right. But that building, like many others, has in the past few years undergone a conversion to luxury residential. And part of that conversion was a restoration of this clock. So it's been working better in recent years than it was before. But that was made by the Claude Neon Sign Company, which was really the original sign company. Georges Claude, the Frenchman.
He invented the commercialization of the sign.
Georges Claude, I don't know if invents quite the right word, but he's basically the father of the commercial use of neon illumination as we know it today. And that is, I think, sort of the indisputable fair thing to say. So, yeah, that when you see that great big neon clock on the Williamsburg Savings Bank Tower in downtown Brooklyn, that was a Claude Neon installation in, I think, 1929 or so. That building, they used to say, was the tallest building between New York and Paris. That, I'm sure, is no longer true, but the clock is still there.
Is most of his work in the United States or Paris?
Well, basically, they licensed franchises, the Claude Neon Company. The Claude name and the sign shops that were using that name were a lot of them operating under license to this, you know, parent company that was based in France. And so it's sort of difficult to say. I think the New York company, which ultimately they were not able to, they tried to kind of to maintain a monopoly on the neon business, and there were just too many incursions, and ultimately the patents that they were claiming expired anyway. So they kind of faded away. And interestingly, the New York Claude Company, which was, I think, directly owned by the French Claude Company, I may be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure it was the case, changed. It was sold off and sold off and sold off again. The Claude name is long gone from this company, but it basically still exists as one of the more prominent sign companies operating in the New York area today.
I think he was, I'm reading his Wikipedia profile, he was imprisoned during World War II from 1944 to 1950. Do you know about that, and did that shut down his company?
He was a Nazi sympathizer, it turned out. Another one of the kind of interesting, quirky things with the history of Neon. But
yeah, that kind of goes back to how it is, because people kind of stereotypically would associate it with, like, modern kind of liberalism.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that the stars on over the Kremlin in Moscow were, I believe, lit with neon. So, I mean, it is, we think of it in this country as kind of like, you know, it obviously has very commercial connotations. But in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, it was not uncommon at all to see neon hammers and sickles. So, it's been different things to different people in different contexts. It's just such a fascinating kind of medium. And the one thing it has is that it is so compelling. If you want to make it the most compelling imaginable hammer and sickle that's going to, you know, really engage passersby, neon is a very effective medium, just the same as it is for a liquor store, on this side of the Atlantic. So quite interesting. But Claude, by the time by the time World War II came around, neon was not such a big thing with Claude anymore. He had another company called Air Liquide, which was related to the neon business. And it would sort of probably, I'd put everyone to sleep, putting that out. But that company actually is still around. I'm not sure exactly, you know, what his relationships to these companies was by the time he was imprisoned. And then he lived until, I think, 1960. But yes, it certainly was not exact. That's not such a great feather in his cap.
I also heard in Cuba, when the revolution happened, they shut down a lot of the signage because prior to the revolution, under Batista, Cuba kind of had a reputation similar to Las Vegas with, like, gambling and prostitution.
It did, and it was absolutely resplendent in neon until the revolution. And to a certain degree, as in the Soviet Union, the Cuban communist regime appropriated neon to a degree. And so movie theaters, for instance, that had their names changed from whatever the pre-revolutionary name was, the names of these theaters kind of changed to sort of, names that were paying homage to prominent figures in the revolution or, you know, other kind of, communist sympathetic figures in Cuban history were changed and sort of relit in new neon after the Cuban Revolution. So neon wasn't completely banished in Cuba by any means. In fact, as far as I know, the big sort of famous likeness of Che Guevara in Havana, this sort of multi-story image of sort of stylized image of Che was backlit with neon when it was originally installed, although that was converted to LED too.
What are your thoughts on the animated signs? They're originally very common in places like Times Square, but I think there's very few left today. I did see one in San Francisco. It was like a giant Coca-Cola sign along the freeway. But I think they're extremely rare today, the animated ones.
Well, yeah, I mean, animating these signs, you know, is something that goes back before neon to the very first incandescent signs. And the makers of these signs found ways to kind of make them almost like little cartoons, you know, and some of them were incredibly elaborate. And, you know, one thing that I've not seen that I would love to see, if it survives anywhere, is an example of the kinds of machinery that enabled these kinds of, you know, elaborate rooftop, animated signs. And you'd have signs, kind of people dancing on them and things like this. And they were, you know, made to all different levels of sophistication. But, you know, now we look at them and, you know, they sort of have this primitive look next to, you know, when you can just put up a giant TV screen, basically. And so those LED TV screens have kind of, you know, put these more traditional kinds of animated signage really out of business.
Can you think of a surviving example? And when was the peak of the animated sign?
The peak of the animated sign was probably, I'd say, in the 50s is when the art really reached its apogee, probably. And then after that, you know, I think there was investment in these sort of big kinds of outdoor electric signs was not what it had been previously, at least in this country. And then, you know, it wasn't long before the kind of early versions of the big LED screens that we have now debuted. And then that at that point, you know, the sort of traditional art of animated electric signs, you know, was not advancing anymore. In terms of surviving examples around, I'm hard pressed to think of one. You know, there must be something somewhere in New York. I'm hard pressed. You know, I know in other cities you see things like there's a great I think a brewery in New Orleans that, you know, still it's sort of a simpler version. It's just a giant sign that spells the name of this company out, you know, one letter at a time, and then the whole thing flashes on and off a few times, and then it turns dark and starts all over again. I'm having a hard time thinking of one. In Long Island City in Queens, there was, you know, there were many kind of big manufacturers that had big roof signs that would be visible from the skyscrapers of Midtown Manhattan. And so, you know, these were great examples of these kinds of signs. The Swing Line Stapler Company, for instance, had one that all the commuters on the Long Island Railroad would pass every day. And it was the stapler that would, you know, staple things, this giant neon stapler. And that sign is gone. A bank took advantage of the grandfathered zoning status of the sign. And so there's a illuminated sign there now, but it's not animated in any way. So where you see something like this surviving, it's really pretty remarkable. In Stockholm, there's a Stomatol toothpaste tube on a rooftop that still has, like, the toothpaste squeezes out of the tube, you know, and it's probably, I'm not sure exactly when that was installed. I think it's a combination of neon and incandescent illumination on that. Not totally sure, but in New York, gosh, I'm having a hard time thinking of one.
I think maybe I did see a few in downtown Vegas.
Vegas probably still has some, yeah. You know, how functional they are now, you know, I'm not sure. But you know, in New York, where, you know, which was home to, you know, some of the most extravagant iterations of these kinds of signs, we've basically given them all up.
You were mentioning the bulb signage, which kind of peaked before neon. I think that was like the 1920s. But I remember when I was in Vegas, I noticed a lot of the hotels that were built and casinos that were built in the 90s, like the New York, the Venetian, Treasure Island. They have like these massive bulb signs.
That is interesting. I mean, you know, that's sort of one thing in New York City that happened with these, I found, is that, you know, you go sort of in the theater district on Broadway, and a lot of the Broadway theater marquees were lit with incandescent bulbs, which I think was a conscious effort to kind of evoke really sort of like the jazz age or sort of pre-jazz age character of the theater district. What I found was that a lot of these theater marquees had actually been neon. So they had been incandescent and then were modernized to neon in, say, the 1930s and 40s, and then were unmodernized and turned back into incandescent signs at a certain point when, for whatever reason, it became, you know, sort of the thing to do.
So the peak was incandescent peaked in the 20s, then neon peaked in the 30s.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Yeah. I mean, incandescent really was peaking and evolving, and then neon kind of came on the scene and really just, you know, displaced it.
Didn't the Great Depression kind of slow it down?
I think the Great Depression kind of, you know, slowed it all down. And, you know, there are historians that would suggest that the sort of the downfall, the downward spiral that Times Square found itself in later in the 20th century really could be traced back to the Depression and even before that decline. So yeah, it certainly put the brakes on it. Although, you know, one of those ironies is that, you know, some of the most sophisticated neon storefront signs in New York City appeared in the 1930s. And I would say that despite the Depression, the 30s was really kind of the heyday of the art in New York.
Pilliter, you were telling me about this place called Wildwood, New Jersey. I mean, I've never been there, but it looks interesting.
That makes me think. I'm not so sure if there's any Wildwood neon, but let's see. I think there definitely is in neon Wildwood, New Jersey. I just looked it up real quick, such as the Caribbean Hotel, Bonita Motel. There's just, like, if you've ever been to Wildwood, New Jersey, it basically, they preserved all the 1950s style motels, and you'll have these very, like, doo-wop styles, and I think it is authentic neon there, such as, like, I think the one's Tahiti Hotel, where it looks like it's all these old tiki Hawaiian.
Have you been to all these places, or you're just looking at the pictures?
Yeah, I've been to these places. I remember staying in, when I was really young, I think it might have been Caribbean Hotel or the Buccaneer, but looking at some of these pictures, I've been to outside of every one of these places. I think Ed's Funcade, I've been in there before. That's classic. That's somewhat modern.
Oh, is it the Boardwalk? Oh.
Yeah, but there's just tons of neon in the Wildwood, New Jersey, and I think also one funny I always put up is the Wawa. In the Wildwood, New Jersey. Yes, it's this big doo-wop thing with the... I think it is a neon, too. It's this giant Wawa pink with the blue. It's kind of silly, and it's one of the unique Wawas in the area, you know?
I think I was in Wildwood as a kid. Wildwood is definitely, you know, kind of one of these sort of places thought of as, like, a kind of hotbed of neon in terms of, you know, in that context, it's really kind of like the roadside Route 66 kinds of motel signs, but they became very much endangered there, as did the sort of architecture that went along with them, these 1950s kind of roadside Americana sorts of places. And so I think for everyone that survives in Wildwood, there's probably a certain number that did not survive. It may even have made, like, the National Trust for Historic Preservation's most endangered list one year, I seem to remember. But it became a real cause célèbre, you know. And you can go there now and I think still see quite a lot of it.
As far as, like, these, like, roadside signs, like in Route 66, what would you say are some of the best examples? Would you say the Southwest or more places like Florida?
It's getting a little bit out of my expertise, which is more neon in the urban context. But there are some that are, you know, really, you know, we've all probably seen in one form or another. They turn up sort of as the backdrop for advertisements and things like that, that have, you know, neon clad women diving, you know, off of diving boards, off of the, you know, motel sign and things like that. Route 66, I think, is typically thought of as, you know, being kind of like the real, you know, ultimate realization of all that kind of thing.
I have seen abandoned ones on road trips, either in California on the Central Valley or the Highway 101, and also like on the drive to Vegas or like the Mojave Desert, you see them. But a lot of them are just kind of like they're like kind of like ruins.
Yeah, and out there, I mean, you know, the weather conditions are really favorable to, you know, something like that surviving with no maintenance for a long time. So they survive to, you know, really become these incredible kind of modern ruins. And if you go on Instagram, you can go down these rabbit holes and not come up probably for weeks. and it's, you know, of people that have really dedicated themselves to photographing and documenting, and it becomes, I can attest, having kind of done it in myself in New York, it becomes, you know, like a sort of compulsive activity to kind of go after these things, and you know, you wind up finding yourself kind of cataloging them and things like that. You know, there is this sense that they are vanishing before your eyes.
I know in downtown LA they are revitalizing a lot of these signs, and a lot of them have just been sitting there and kind of abandoned for like several decades. And now that downtown LA is being revitalized, they're restoring a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, in LA it has had a much better kind of story of, you know, people really taking an interest in these signs and recognizing them for their cultural relevance and organizing to save them. And this goes back to the 80s, but there's Los Angeles has the Museum of Neon Art, which has over the years been involved in preserving signs in situ, now has its own beautiful museum where a lot of the signs that have been, you know, not been able to be preserved at their original locations have been kind of gathered together and restored and are displayed, you know, kind of in a group. And seeing them all together is an incredible, you know, it's this really sort of like stimulating thing to see them all kind of gathered together. There are a couple other places, the American Sign Museum in Cincinnati. If you happen to find yourself in Cincinnati.
I've never even been to the L.A. I mean, I should go there. There is an L.A. Neon Museum, but I'm just thinking of, like, the main streets downtown, like Broadway.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, there was an effort that the museum was kind of associated with, at least at one point, I think, to really be sure that these things were preserved in situ, you know, outdoors, kind of in their original locations. And so, you know, L.A. has really... you know, kind of recognize the cultural value of these signs. And so they've had a much better kind of rate of survival there than they have in New York, where there's been, you know, basically certainly no kind of organized effort to preserve them. You know, and they've really kind of slipped through the cracks of the various historic preservation, you know, kind of apparatuses that there are here.
Pilliter, what have been some of your observations from Philly?
For neon, it's kind of non-existent. Ever been to Philadelphia on neon? I mean, there is the Terminal Market, which is basically where there was the that's where you get all the food, and it's like the ice cream and kind of like, and other than that, you could say I'm not so sure if there's anything on South Street. I'm not so sure if South Street has that, but I will say there is some neon in the Terminal Market. That one ice cream place I am looking up. It's a very famous ice cream. I think it's Bassett Incorporated. It's a very famous ice cream place because in China.
Oh, and then there's the Gino Steaks.
Yeah, in China, the green ice cream is famous because it's the one of the only. I forget that green leaf. It goes in there, but there's a lot of Chinese that hang out at the Bassett ice cream. It's kind of they also have like this weird headquarters in China too, and they kind of take pride on that. But the I mean, yeah, the Reading. Oh, yeah, I'm looking at it right now. The Reading Terminal Market sign, I could say, is some kind of old neon. Looking at it, and and when you walk in, there's the Wands Fresh and Cooked Seafood, the cheesesteak. But yeah, there is some of that neon. I mean, only from Terminal Market, but I can't recall anything. If there's something on South Street, I'm thinking about. I feel like neon is just reserved for like Times Square in Las Vegas.
Thomas, you were in Buenos Aires, Argentina 10 years ago, and you recently wrote about that. Can you talk about your experience and a lot of the signage that you saw? Were they concentrated in one district? Because I looked up Buenos Aires neon on Google, and it seems to be there's like this one street where there's a high concentration.
Well, I mean, at that time, I wasn't really seeking them out. I just happened to be there, and it seemed like every corner I turned around, there were, you know, just these great old signs that were, you know, almost all of them were lighting up at night. And so without really trying or going out of my way at all, you know, I found myself with this, you know, kind of like great photo album of these signs when I was back in the States. And unfortunately, I've been back in 10 years. God, I'd love to go back. But I mean, some of them in doing a little research after the fact were on, say, theaters that were, you know, really landmark theaters in Buenos Aires that were, you know, where these signs went back to the 1930s and were still, you know, very functional and had the appearance of having been there all along. And it was just a city of like all kinds of great relics like this. These things really kind of fit into a context of other kinds of great relics that would have disappeared from most American cities, but down there were still, you know, alive and well. So I don't know how many of the things that I saw there 10 years ago are still around now. I know a lot of the things you'd see in New York 10 years ago are not still around. So be interesting to see.
Does Buenos Aires, is it a high concentration of Art Deco architecture?
I've not certainly wouldn't call myself an expert in the architectural history of Buenos Aires, but certainly there are great Art Deco buildings there. I mean, at one point, the tallest building in South America was there, which is a great Art Deco skyscraper. And so, yeah, I mean, it's certainly there were, you know, great Art Deco movie theaters and you know, architecture of that period built in that city that would you know, really be on a par with the best buildings of those of that period you'd see in any city.
I think one of them you posted, I'm looking up, is the Luna Stadium.
Yeah, Luna Park, which is sort of like a big arena concert hall kind of thing, which when I was there had this incredible sign that advertised the upcoming shows and even the dates that were going to be there. So, I mean, we think of neon signs as being typically, you know, things that are, you know, kind of built, you know, to not really be changed, you know, to sort of be more or less a permanent installation. But this sign was remarkable in that it had these letters that could just be kind of taken out and rearranged to spell out, you know, whatever was going to be coming up there. And you see in historic photos other kinds of instances of this in the U.S., but I don't think I've seen anything quite like it in my lifetime in this country. So it was really sort of the kind of contraption, you know, that here in the United States probably has been, you know, outmoded for one or two generations, that down there was just another one of these great, amazing, wonderful relics that just added so much to the, you know, kind of, you know, the beauty of the streetscapes there.
Were there other cities you visited, the ones in, say, Europe, where you noticed a high concentration of neon?
I found, I pay more and more attention to it over the years. I was just in Amsterdam for the first time in almost 20 years. And 20 years ago, I really wasn't paying attention to this very much at all. And was really surprised to see that in a city like Amsterdam that is, you know, certainly not a city that's hard up, you know, certainly not for any kind of pedestrian traffic. You know, so a city that can afford to modernize pretty much as it wills, you know, tons of old neon signs all over the city. I couldn't believe it, you know, just having been there, and was also kind of surprised that I knew that some of these things were definitely places I'd walked right past. How could I not have remembered this from 20 years ago? You know, you get Amsterdam also has, you know, the red light district has its seedy side, and neon has that sort of seedy connotation to it. And so there's a certain, you know, kind of association that goes on there. But Amsterdam also has, you know, some great Art Deco movie theaters, for instance, that have, you know, really just, you know, great neon signs and big neon roof signs and things like this that you see in Amsterdam, and you know, really. It was really kind of a surprise, you know, and I think it's the kind of thing, maybe I can attest that it's the kind of thing you can walk past and not notice, you know, and it just doesn't resonate with you at all, but it's there, you know, right in front of you. Stockholm was another city I was in recently that had, you know, really a surprising amount of neon and really old neon and old storefront neon. So these are some of the wealthiest cities in the world, and it was kind of a pleasant surprise to me to see that these, you know, wealthy modern cities somehow, you know, these really kind of fragile, ephemeral relics, you know, found a place in the streets of these cities and have been able to survive there. It's hard to say without doing a real scientific study, you know, but do these things have a better rate of survival in cities like Amsterdam or Stockholm than they do in New York? And if so, why is that?
Yeah, I mean, I was in London, and London's comparable to New York. London's taken down most of its old neon signs. I mean, Piccadilly Circus used to be that way, and now it's all just electronic LED billboards and electronic screens. One of my favorite ones in London was the Regent Palace Hotel sign, and that's gone.
Yeah, Piccadilly Circus being like Times Square has kind of had the same experience that Times Square had in terms of its signage, and so, you know, the kind of classics have all been modernized over the years, but you know, I found that there's a on like the theater marquees of the West End, there's really quite a lot. And some of the old movie theaters in that area as well. I was sort of pleasantly surprised at how much I found there just very recently. And, you know, wonder kind of, you know, there too, how that really would compare against New York if you were to do it kind of scientifically.
Didn't you say you also went to a few cities? You went to Istanbul and a city in Africa?
Yeah, I've been to a few cities in you know, kind of developing countries in the last couple of years. And there I find that in these cities, there's much less neon. The signs are really very few and far between. I'm sure, I know Rio, for example, I found, you know, you walk around, you really see almost none, really almost zero. And, you know, it could be not having spent very much time there that just, you know, I didn't see these great things that, you know, maybe are there to see. But, I, you know, just kind of having wandering in the same way in that city that I did in, say, Stockholm, for instance, you know, I saw much, much less. You know, it was in Dar es Salaam, in Tanzania, in Dhaka in Bangladesh, and other cities in the Middle East, and in Havana, for another city that you could say is a capital of the developing world. And you don't see much. There's some kind of, maybe this gets back to the same, you know, thing that we started out talking about, Greenwich Village. There's a certain kind of link between a certain level of prosperity and neon. You know, what I found more typically in cities in developing countries was LEDs were everywhere. You know, so I think maybe it's just sort of the you know, economic realities, or, you know, if there's neon has never been cheap. It's always,
I'm sure, Asian cities like Tokyo or in Hong Kong.
But when I was last there in 2011 in that part of the world, you know, this is a part of the world that really embraced, in cities like Tokyo and in various Chinese cities, embraced neon to a degree that no American city could hardly even hold a candle to, Hong Kong as well. And 5 years ago when I was there, you could really see that these cities were transitioning to LED big time. And so there were some, you know, very, very elaborate neon signs and neon signs that were doing these little tricks that I'd never seen signs do in the U.S. That really were, you know, kind of had one foot in the grave almost. And you know, LED was just really kind of breathing down their necks. And so I suspect that if I were to go back now, I would see, you know, a lot of these really great neon signs that I saw 5 years ago are probably, you know, many of them gone completely.
Yeah, I think I even saw a documentary on YouTube about this neon sign maker in Hong Kong, he's like in his 70s now, talking about how he's going out of business.
Yeah, there have been a number of kind of looks at the subject in Hong Kong, which was famous for all of its neon, and how basically LEDs have kind of, you know, really changed the landscape there.
You mentioned there was a decline in neon towards the 80s. What do you think about are you familiar with those, like, 1980s retro-futuristic illustrations based on, like, sci-fi films that show all these futuristic cities covered in all this, like, pink and turquoise neon?
Well, I mean, the ultimate example is like Blade Runner, right? And it's kind of interesting. You know, this is getting off into kind of another rabbit hole of you know, the sort of like cultural reads that people have, you know, taken on the subject. I'm certainly aware of these things. Quite what to make of them? I might not be the best person to ask, but it's kind of interesting that these cultural representations were appearing at a time when, you know, neon was probably just about a rock bottom. you know, because it hadn't quite yet reached that sort of like level of nostalgic appeal that it has acquired since. So it was really kind of on the outs.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of ironic because there's this whole genre of music called like new retro wave, and all the artists like put neon in their thing. There's even a 80s new retro wave club in Stockholm called Club Neon. So it's kind of ironic.
Yeah.
Yes. The whole like where neon itself becomes an aesthetic and genre you want to live out, or at least that there's some nostalgia of the past and you want to be near that kind of stuff.
We are at the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, Thomas, what is the best way for people to get in touch with you if they're interested in taking your tour?
Go on Google and Google me, Thomas Rinaldi and New York Neon, and I hopefully will be the first thing that comes up. And each blog post that I post a link to where you can get tickets to the tours. They are sponsored, the tours that I'm doing now, by a group called Untapped Cities, which is a fantastic kind of series of articles that they do on neon and other kinds of, you know, just great sort of laid between the lines things that there are to find, particularly in New York. So, yeah, Untapped Cities, neon tours, you can Google my name and yeah, that should get you there.
Thomas Rinaldi, it's been an excellent show. We've covered a lot of interesting topics. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you so much, Robert. It's been a pleasure again. Yeah, thanks again for the opportunity.
And thanks, Billiter.
It's nice talking like always.